Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For over 16 years, the threat of a massive LNG export terminal at Coos Bay, fed by a 230-mile, 36-inch-wide gas pipeline snaking across five counties, loomed over southern Oregon. Then, on January 19th, this project received its quite likely death blow when the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission upheld Oregon DEQ's denial of a crucial permit. This is not the first time this project seemed to be defeated, but prospects look bleaker than ever for the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connector gas pipeline to ever get built. Today we talk with three people who have been fighting this pipeline with every fiber of their being. Stacy McLaughlin owns a ranch in Douglas County that would be on the pipeline route. Kaila Farrell-Smith is a Klamath Modoc Indian whose people have been fighting this pipeline for 16 years. And Ali Rosenbluth, campaigns director for Rogue Climate in Phoenix, Oregon, has devoted the last 5 years of her life to stopping Jordan Cove LNG and the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. Stacy, Kaila, and Ali, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having us, Barbara.
It's great to be back. Thanks. Good to see you all.
And I think actually, Stacy, this is the first time that you've been on Locus Focus, so welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start talking about this by just mentioning 16 years. What does that mean to all of you? I'll start with Stacy, since you've been in this fight the longest.
What it means to me is a lot of my life lost in reflecting back through the years in dealing with this pipeline. A common statement that I make to people often is, I hope I can start to remember my kids' birthdays like I remember deadlines for public comment. It's been quite a journey of unrest and certainly stress and learning. I will say that it's been quite a learning experience for me with respect to my awareness of the environment and environmental concerns and how much more I've learned than I actually knew about. I thought I was pretty well versed in it. And I also thought that I was doing all the right things. And I will say that what I have learned through this with respect to fracking and the lack of awareness around sustainable energy and its importance to us versus our ongoing dependence with fossil fuels has been amazing. So it's had its upside and its downside. Upside is I've learned. Downside is that I've lost a lot of my time and energy to something that is at best only a few years away from being obsolete, I hope.
Kaila, your people have been fighting not just Jordan Cove, they've been fighting a whole lot of stuff for a really long time. And I wonder if you can put that in perspective of how long you've been involved in the fight against Jordan Cove. And then I know you must have talked to other tribal members about the effect that that's had on their lives and on the work that they're doing, not just to protect the tribes from this immediate hazard, but all the other fights that they've been having historically since white settlement started.
It was really actually exciting and great news to get to hear that that FERC stood with Oregon's denial of the water permit on the very last day of Trump's administration. To be completely honest, Ali and I were texting the evening before, and I had prepared a statement. We were assuming that it was going to be the opposite and that we were going to have to begin on that with a new administration in that fight. So it was really exciting news. We celebrated that day and still are, so it was really exciting. But yeah, in the context, the Klamath tribes has been opposed to Jordan Cove LNG, really in solidarity with Standing Rock and the No Dakota Access Pipeline fight. I've been an environmental activist and community organizer for 20 years. I worked a lot with OSPIRG in Portland, canvassing. I was a lead field manager. So I've been working on campaigns for two decades here in the state of Oregon. And so I understand, how the permitting process works and but how public pressure is really, really what it takes to change a narrative. And I think that's really, at least my role since Standing Rock the last 4 years has been As an artist, I kind of moved on from that community organizing aspect and went back into my art career, and really felt that I could make more change as an artist. And so when I joined, you know, this community here in Southern Oregon and my tribe standing against Jordan Cove LNG, it was really as a creative and as an art mentor. So I worked with like Rogue Climate. I'm a board member on Rogue Climate. It's been so wonderful to work with all, I mean, it's the immense energy and time of the people that have come together to organize landowners, like Stacy. And I personally was a legal intervener in this fight. And I went and was filmed and spoke to DEQ when I lived in Portland. And so, you know, since in the last few years, I've now moved home to my ancestral homelands here in Chiloquin. So just doing that land acknowledgement, you know, just acknowledge with the ancestors here, the Klamath, Modoc, Yahooskin, the Paiute people in Southern Oregon. And we've lived here in this, you know, beautiful place of headwaters, of spring waters, of clean, clean, cold water and riverways since time immemorial. And so, you know, it was really powerful to get to organize and work with the Klamath Youth Council and the Klamath Tribe and coming together with so many Klamath people. Don Gentry, our chairman, Rowena Jackson, you know, wrote these incredible poems. So really the artists that came together, Rowena Jackson has like a really incredible artwork. So we really like came together with banners and signs and t-shirts and hats and represented for our community, you know. And so it was like, well, we had like almost 300 people here in Klamath Falls that testified to Vicki Walker, to the Department of State Lands, which was a lot of people for this county. And so we went to Medford, you know, there was like, it was like going to a rock concert, you know, like I like got me and Rowena, I was like, come on, Rowena, like I know how to get to the front of the line. And like we got in and we testified a second time and I was able to film Rowena. She wrote this really powerful poem that we were able to, you know, get on record. And so it was just a really, really powerful experience to get to work with so many people, including Alley, Rogue Climate. I work with Signal Fire, Rising Tide. It was just a really immense, you know, we went on a lot of hikes and just, you know, hiked the pipeline route. So it's been a really special time.
Well, Alley, I got an email from you guys on January 18th saying that FERC had moved up their meeting, which should have been on that Thursday traditionally, but they moved it up to the 19th, which was the last day of Trump's administration. And you felt like there was some real funny business about to go on. And so you were urging everybody to send emails and make phone calls. It turns out the phone line was down and their mailbox was full. I think that we were all expecting a very different outcome. So I just wanted to get your sense about why you expected a different outcome and what your reaction was when the outcome came out as it did.
Yeah, that's a great question, Barbara. So as many folks listening probably know, Jordan Cove was actually denied by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in 2016, but the company quickly reapplied as soon as the Trump administration stepped into office because some top Trump advisors had made statements about their excitement about ensuring that an LNG export terminal on the west coast of the United States was going to happen. And we knew that they were talking about Jordan Cove LNG. So this project was rebooted, which was really heartbreaking for folks all across our region who had already spent 10 years fighting it. So when FERC moved their most recent meeting from the 21st to the 19th, so the day before Biden stepped into office, we smelt funny business, right? Like the Trump administration had made it clear that they wanted to support this project, and Jordan Cove LNG had made it clear that they were trying to bypass the state's authority by going to the feds to get permits overturned, which they are still trying to do. And hearing from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that day that actually they were going to uphold Oregon's denial of the Clean Water Act permit was so exciting and so unexpected, and a real testament to the amount of work that so many people put into writing comments and speaking out to DEQ, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and Governor Brown to make sure that permit was denied back in 2019.
I'm wondering if you think that all that last push that started on January 18th to really emphasize to FERC that this is a no-go, I'm wondering if that had any influence on the decision, or if this decision had already been baked in before they decided to move the meeting up.
It's a really technical decision that they made. It's a very like intense process piece. And so, you know, I think that the years and years and years of folks from Oregon and all across the Pacific Northwest speaking out against this project has built up and led to great decisions like this happening. But the decision that FERC made was extremely technical, and you know, it still upholds Oregon's Clean Water Act denial, but it more has to do with who has authority to overturn permits like that. And FERC says, actually, no, like legally, we don't have the authority to do that for some very like complicated, nuanced pieces.
It's interesting that coming out of the Trump administration, since Trump was not caring that, for instance, Mike Pence did not have the authority to overturn the Electoral College vote, or that any of the other Republican officials in Georgia that he was contacting had the ability to do the things he was demanding. So I just find this irony that while Trump was not exactly noted for trying to follow actual law and policies, that for some reason FERC decided that they should. And I don't know, do you have any idea, Stacey? I mean, you seem like, I know that from talking to you over the last few years that you have a lot of thinking about the intricacies of political decision making. And do you have any thoughts about what might have been going on in FERC's mind?
I think there's a lot of pressure on FERC with respect to private property rights across the nation, which has really impacted the way that they're considering some of these things. Also, the 401 fight out of New York was very clear about states' rights. And so there's a lot of good history and a lot of good background. The other thing is, I think that I really want to pass out some applause to the state of Oregon. They did an excellent job on putting together the documentation. And I know that some of us kind of questioned at the beginning the path that they were taking to make their arguments. And essentially, they were making the right argument all along and really had put things together in a very solid way. FERC had no option other than to support the state of Oregon based on the evidence that they presented. And I think they realized that. Had this gone to court, FERC would have had a resounding loss. So I think in one sense, they were kind of cutting their losses and running with it. Also, I think that there is a bit of a new day at FERC. I don't know if you want to call it a Hail Mary or an end run, what they tried to do that day with respect to making decisions at the last day of Trump's term. I think that they recognize that we don't get to ignore climate issues anymore. And not just with respect to Trump's lack of science on it. I mean, he's really not in the picture anymore. I just do not give him a lot of time on this. But the Biden administration was very clear coming in that they will be paying attention to climate issues and climate change. We saw that very quickly on when Biden put us back into the Paris Climate Agreement. So I think they know. I think they know that it's important. And it's interesting to note that the change in leadership at FERC now with Glick as the chairman, I think will start setting a new tone. And if you listen to the meeting at all, I had a couple of chuckles in there with Chatterjee, who's very much been on the pro-fracking and pro-gas pipeline infrastructure. He was doing a kind of a few backwards dance steps in that meeting, which I think was reassuring. I don't know if that's because he wants to keep his job or if he's looking for a new job, but I think it was an interesting decision. They definitely made the right call. And Barbara, when you talk about it being political, there's no question that any decision FERC makes doesn't have political overtones. And clearly there's a partisan issue that was involved in all of that.
Let's mention who Glick is, because a lot of listeners probably don't know who you were talking about there.
Glick is now the new chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. He was a dissenting voice as a commissioner before with respect to the Jordan Cove permitting process that FERC approved.
This is Richard Glick. We should give him his full name.
We'll give him his full name. I just call him commissioner, now chairman. I think that One of the things that's really important to note here is that FERC's attention to private property rights and landowners is reassuring to me as somebody who's been dealing with this, and clearly it's an impact, I think, to tribal lands as well. I won't speak to that, but I will say from my standpoint, I think that the few folks that stay the course will be changing history with respect to this. And I think there's a new respect around what we're supposed to be doing as a country when it comes to infrastructure. So let's hope. Let's hope that we have a new day.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFGLPFM and KODXLPFM, KMUN and KCPB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking about the impending demise of the Jordan Cove LNG Export Terminal and Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline. We're talking with Douglas County property owner Stacy McLaughlin, who's been in this fight for, I don't remember what, 13, 14 years. Klamath Modoc artist Kaila Farrell-Smith and Allie Rosenbluth, who is with Rogue Climate. Allie, you've been in this fight probably less time personally, though you've been fighting LNG, I guess, since you were in college, which is quite a while. But I wanted to get a sense of your perspective on walking into a fight that had been going on already at least 10 years when you joined it, and to see it maybe coming this close to being over.
Yeah, that's a great question, Barbara. I've been so incredibly lucky these last 5 years to get to meet the incredible community that makes up this fight against Jordan Cove LNG, right? Stacy and Kaila are two of those folks, but there are hundreds more who I am so lucky to get to know and have been so inspired by how resilient so many people are in our communities to continue fighting this thing for, you know, over 15 years now. I felt like I was in the right place at the right time when I moved to Southern Oregon after, you know, fighting the Cove Point LNG export terminal in college in Virginia, and moving here and learning about this LNG export terminal proposal in Southern Oregon and getting involved. And once I met the amazing people in this community, I knew that it was going to be a long haul and that we were going to fight it all together and that I was going to have everybody's backs the best way that I could.
Stacy, you have a very interesting relationship with one of your neighbors who you've been fighting shoulder to shoulder to stop the pipeline. And I want to have you talk a little bit about the people that you've met and the people that you've gotten to be friends with who you probably would have never gotten to know otherwise.
Okay. Well, probably not just one of my neighbors. Probably the majority of my neighbors land on a different end of the political spectrum and value system spectrum than I do. So that's been both a blessing and quite a challenge. And a blessing in that I have learned that when people find common ground, they can get things done. Without that, I think it's nearly impossible. I think that if we find ways to focus on the personal relationship with one another and not our politics per se, it helps us accomplish the end that we need. Most of my neighbors are very, very conservative, and I am not. In fact, I'm probably quite the opposite of that. And it's been interesting to learn. Like I said, this has been an extraordinary learning experience. And I will say that that's been the same for my neighbors, too, that we've all been able to move off of our own personal soapboxes and listen a little bit better than maybe we might have otherwise. I don't know that a lot of the relationships will be lasting beyond this. I think that we shall see. We shall see what evolves and develops. But I know that I've seen quite a bit of growth in a lot of my neighbors being able to listen and learn from other perspectives. We have a large LGBTQ community that's been involved in this struggle in our area, not only from property ownership, but their activism. And it was really kind of reassuring to me to watch my neighbors understand the lifestyle and learn about the people and be able to grow beyond some of their biases. And so I appreciate that. I'm struggling, as many of you probably are, with the understanding the Trump cult effect that seems to have overtaken many people in rural areas. And I equate a lot of it to the white supremacy aspect of it. I don't know that other people do, but I do know that a lot of my neighbors probably fall in that camp. And it's been, I think when you can get to the personal, Barbara, like you said, versus just staying on the surface, we learn and we're able to understand and grasp things. So they've learned about the environment. They've learned about what it means to care about the land through the eyes of not just property ownership, but preserving it and protecting it from an environmental standpoint. I also think that there's been an awareness of the indigenous people and their rights to the land that we now occupy, and that I'm graced with and have the opportunity to now call it mine, but it certainly wasn't. And I came by it legitimately, but the people in the past did not. And so that kind of history has to be, we have to deal with that. And I think the pipeline fight is, you know, really helped us turn a lot of pages on a lot of different aspects. It's not just about the pipeline in Jordan Cove. It's about relationships. It's about learning about each other's cultures. It's about the truth behind the land. It's about everybody that exists within a community having a say. So it's been a really lovely journey, but it's been a trying journey. I can't say I've enjoyed a lot of it, but I have enjoyed what I've observed from the 30,000 foot level with respect to people's behaviors. And my particular neighbor that you're talking about will remain nameless, but I think has shown some personal growth in a lot of areas, both environmentally as well within his understanding and acceptance of different people. And I also think that some of us have learned too, you know, we like to, and I'll get off my soapbox here in just 1 second, but I know that we like to hold white males hostage right now to a lot of things. In many cases, it's well-deserved. But in other cases, you know, you're not going to tell a man who started working at 14 years old, taking care of his family, you know, that he's privileged when he doesn't understand what the meaning of privilege is in modern day reference versus privilege as he understands it, because he's worked hard. And that's how a lot of my neighbors equate it, is that there was no privilege given to me, but you know, the understanding is not there yet, but we're getting there. We're making progress.
Well, Kaila, I wonder, what's your perspective of meeting all the landowners, some of them who had no idea that they were living on stolen land? Do you get a sense of seeing a learning curve on their part as they get to meet and work more closely with the tribes and understand the tribe's perspective on their relationship to the land?
Okay. Hi. Yeah. Thanks, Barbara. I can only speak from my personal experience. I can't speak. I'm not a, you know, I'm tribal council, and Don Gentry or spokespeople from the tribe are not on this call. So I'm only speaking for myself, and I'm new to this community, to my community, to my ancestral community here in Chiloquin and Modoc Point. I do live rurally. I have ranch and forest land. Our land is not in the line of the pipeline, so I'm not in that experience of the landowners. During events, you know, like when I met folks who were landowners who were, you know, on our side of stopping Jordan Cove LNG, I've only had really positive interactions with people during my time. But I have, like I said, I was a canvasser for 11 years, so I knocked on doors and talked to people across communities across this country. I learned how to knock on people's doors and talk to Republicans, and they were always really sweet, and they'd invite me in, and we'd have tea, and we would agree to disagree on some things, but it was always just a positive interaction. So I have a lot of training as an organizer to have positive interactions, and so that's how I engage with, you know, my voice and activism and in my relationship building in general. So, you know, I live in a community that would probably be similar to what Stacy was describing. I also promised myself that I was not going to share Donald Trump's image when he got elected. And I believe that it is called a Trump derangement syndrome on both sides of the aisle. So I think there's definitely culty people on the white supremacy side, but there's also culty people on the other side. So I kind of just stay away from judging people that way. And saying that, all the folks that I met, and even at like the last time we were able to all be in public before COVID, we were in Salem. You know, I was talking to one of the, they're ranch people. They're, and they, you know, were like, "Are you a Chiliquin girl?" And I was like, "Yep." And then we're here and we're all on the same side. So, you know, it's like, from that, I would say that, yeah, the tribe has had good interactions with people. And, you know, we were at that, the DSL meeting in Klamath Falls, and I don't know where people fall in like political spectrums and stuff like that, but we were all there together to protect the water, you know, and to protect the land and to protect this beautiful place that we all share now. And that's kind of how my father raised me, very much not in a racist sense, but to include and welcome people into conversation and into ceremony, which is how I was raised, and that was my father's work. So Alfred Leo Smith from the Freedom of Religion case, Smith versus Oregon. So I was in Washington, D.C. when I was 7 years old, when the Supreme Court was making that decision. And I learned about having to speak in front of cameras and how to speak to journalists and to speak to reporters and stuff like that. So I've kind of been in this position my whole life. So when it came to this, I wanted to use, you know, I was seeing some of the youth, and, you know, a lot of people aren't ready to take those platforms as a spokesperson. It takes a lot of years of practice, and to not get jarred, you know, in the politics of the nature of these things. But, you know, over 15 years, it doesn't matter if it was Democrats or Republicans, they've been trying to push this thing through the whole time. But I'm really excited. I just want to mention, you know, just a big shout out to Taylor Tupper and her father, Rayson Tupper. I just want to acknowledge Rayson as an elder who was at every single event. He always had his No LNG sign, and Rayson passed this year and or last year. And so I just want to acknowledge and recognize his work and fight at the tribal level. And I think it's positive. I think we can come together as communities, and I think just bringing awareness. And the thing is with ignorance is a lot of people don't know anything about Indigenous people. And is it by design? You know, who teaches that? Is it taught in schools? You know, like there's a lot of ignorance in the United States of America. And it comes back to that narrative again. So, you know, I really wanted to engage my part and my story, my father's story and my tribe's story, into this conversation. And so Allie and Rogue Climate were really sweet in helping me. You know, we were suing FERC, and I wrote a declaration representing 700,000 supporters of Rogue Climate and as a Klamath tribal member, and wrote my story. And so that was a part of, you know, of us suing FERC. And so I wanted to just make sure that narrative was included in this, and that it has been an Indigenous led you know, struggle, and that we as a tribe and as Klamath people have been a part of this fight throughout the whole time, as well, like you mentioned in the beginning, Barbara, that we are fighting for clean water rights. We're fighting to bring 4 dams down off the Klamath River, regardless if they're putting a pipeline underneath it. We need to take those dams down. We need to get our salmon back. It's been over 100 years. So, you know, the fight goes on.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFT LPFM and KODXL PFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking about the impending demise of Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. And we're talking with Douglas County property owner Stacy McLaughlin, Klamath Modoc artist Kaila Farrell-Smith, and Allie Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate. This is not quite over yet, and I guess the last time, Allie, you and I talked, you were referring to the Zombie Project. Maybe we just could do a little bit of a brief history about why you call this a zombie project and how much faith you have that the zombie will finally be put out of its misery sometime soon.
We have called this the zombie project because it has this ability to really rise from the dead. You know, folks like Stacy and so many others in Southern Oregon have been fighting this project since like 2004. And throughout that process, we've seen denials, we've had permits overturned, and it has just keep coming back. But when this final round, well, hopefully final round of Jordan Cove LNG permitting started back in 2017, we knew that we needed the state to finally make a call on Jordan Cove LNG, and we knew that we needed them to deny critical permits for this project, including the Clean Water Act permit, which was recently upheld by FERC, that denial. And we have also seen the state of Oregon deny the federal consistency review for the Coastal Zone Management Act permit, which is another critical permit that the project can't move forward without. Additionally, the amount of pressure that we put on the Department of State Lands meant that the Department of State Lands sent a letter to the company actually saying, making it really clear that they weren't going to get this permit, and the company pulled out. So these three really critical permits that the state of Oregon has to make the call on Jordan Cove are communities coming together across political spectrums, across differences to stop this project has really paid off. And now the state of Oregon not only has denied the permits that we've been asking them to deny for years, but they're also defending those permits in court. So like what Stacey said earlier about how the state of Oregon's argument to FERC is really a huge part of the reason why FERC upheld their denial is so critical and is due to the pressure that we put on the state to do just that. So the win in January was huge, and we are continuing to fight Jordan Cove LNG until, you know, it's dead for good, and that landowners like Stacy aren't under the threat of eminent domain. And so, you know, the company is still trying to bypass the state permitting process. They had a huge loss to that strategy in January, but we're actually going to see on sometime before February 9th, which is this Tuesday, we will find out whether or not the U.S. Secretary of Commerce will overturn Oregon's denial of the Coastal Zone permit. So right now we're asking folks to email the U.S. Secretary of Commerce. You can go to roadclimate.org or Road Climate or No LNG Exports on Facebook to click, find the link to send an email to the U.S. Secretary of Commerce to tell them not to overturn Oregon's denial of this project, because it's just really critical that we continue standing up against Pembina's strategy, which is to just bypass the state permitting process. And Oregon has clear authority to stop this project, and they've asserted that. And we're going to stand with the state and make sure that these denials that we fought so hard for are upheld for good.
So what do you think are the chances that the Secretary of Commerce will take a different turn than the former Secretary of Commerce under the Trump administration would have taken?
I think it's really hard to tell. And I think that we can't predict these things. Like, you know, I predicted incorrectly what happened at FERC in January. And so I think it's really critical that we all raise our voices. We all make sure that it's known that people in our communities don't want this project to move forward. And we make sure that the Biden administration hears that loud and clear until we have truly stopped this project and people stop living underneath this threat.
We'll put a link to Road Climate so people can follow your suggestion and let the Secretary of Commerce know that, how you feel about having them not override Oregon's permitting ability. One of the things that I heard, Stacey, was that you have some concerns that even though Jordan Cove can't move ahead yet since FERC is upholding Oregon's denial of the clean water permit, but you have some concerns that the eminent domain aspects of this project might continue. So let's first of all talk about what the concerns are about eminent domain and how and what your concerns are about how that could take force even though this project's still in limbo.
Once FERC issues the certificate, the approval, that enables the company to condemn properties, to enact eminent domain. We have a little higher level of protection than some pipeline folks might have because FERC also told them that they can't begin construction. And that's been one of the really difficult points is what does construction mean? To me, it means anything. To the pipeline company, it means putting pipe in the ground. So they would oftentimes come in and start pre-construction activities, which in many cases meant falling trees, clearing the land, doing a lot of things that were still very disruptive that impacted the property owners, even though they did not yet have permission to build because they didn't have all the permits that they needed in place. So effectively, if Pembina wanted to today, they could condemn our property and take us to court and start to take possession of the easement ground on our land, which is, you know, clearly not something that we want to have happen. And so I think that that's one of the things that will be taken under consideration. And I know that both Senator Merkley and Wyden have legislation that they've proposed that would deal with this. And, you know, so there's different starting lines for me versus for them versus the courts and so forth. And, you know, I'm in a particularly difficult situation just personally that may also affect other neighbors. And that is that both of the neighbors on both sides of me have signed easements. Now, one of the questions there is, and I don't know that we've had it answered yet, but the concern is, all right, if I'm a landowner and I've signed for an easement, can they start working on my property if I give them permission for that? I want to say, no, they can't, because FERC has said you can't do anything until you have everything in place. So I kind of think that's where it stands. I'm not a lawyer, and I haven't argued that with anybody or really. But, I we're still very much at risk, even without all the approvals in place at this point in time. And the other concern that landowners have about that easement is that it will be used for something other than natural gas if they abandon this project. And there are, of course, we know the tar sands issues and all of that out of Canada, which, you know, we really do think that there's a lot of value in just the easement to go to the port of Coos Bay. And so that's why I think we're really going to stand our ground with respect to this.
What happens with these people who've sold their easements? Does that mean that they have given basically the right to Pembina to do whatever Pembina wants to do on the property?
Only as it pertains to the permit and as to the certificate from the easement. The easements are, having not seen everybody's easement language, and it's probably different for a lot of different property owners, what they asked for, what they were able to get, how much that piece of property was critical to Pembina so that they would give in to some of the landowner demands. And so it sort of depends. Right now, you know, as long as we're holding out and the pipeline's not getting built, these folks got a big paycheck and not a lot of risk to their property. But that will always be hanging over their heads, that easement. As it is now, I don't have that mile-long easement on my property. So, and it's not about the dollar value for me at all. So there's no price for our family.
And I just want to uplift the resilience of Stacy and so many other landowners who have just continued to say no to this company, no matter how annoying they got. I feel like often that appreciation doesn't get heard enough. And I just think it's really, really, we wouldn't be here today stopping this project if it wasn't for Stacy and the other landowners who will never sell. And that's huge. And that needs to be applauded. So thank you, Stacy, for the years of saying no that you've done. It's huge.
You know, Allie, I appreciate that very much. And, you know, I want to follow in her footsteps a bit and commend the people who did not sign easements. In fact, we even have one landowner who went out and bought another piece of property in the pipeline route to further the voice. It was really a critical piece of property, and they now own that. And, you know, the other thing I think that's really inspirational in this is that we have a lot of elderly people who have been intimidated in a lot of bullying kinds of ways by the company. And my neighbors and some of the other folks on the pipeline that have been resolute in not signing have really been very protective and taken care of them. You know, we've had people who've had deaths in their families. We've watched over them. We've had one of our landowners we found out had serious dementia, and the pipeline company was taking advantage of him. And so we stepped in and were able to secure and get him help, and he's now well taken care of. And so it does reaffirm some of the goodness in humanity with respect to the individuals in these communities and how they do take care of one another. You know, Pembina likes to portray themselves as a good neighbor, and yet all of the underhanded ways that they approached the permitting processes and telling the state of Oregon that they were going to do this and they were going to do that when they had no intention of doing that, and trying to circumvent the system in order to secure their means to any end, was very evident that they don't know what good neighbor means.
Well, Stacy, I understand that there are some concerns on your property, even though you haven't signed an easement, that you sort of mentioned that Pembina can move in with eminent domain and start clearing the path for the pipeline on your property, even though you haven't signed and even though they don't have the permit yet. So I wanted to just dig a little bit more into that and what your worst concerns are and how you think you can stave that off.
Well, we were lucky in that because of the outcry and because of the things that have happened, unfortunately, and victimized landowners in other parts of the country with respect to the damages to their property and the legal struggles around that, we benefited to the extent that Pembina was advised they can't clear any trees, they can't do anything. So we're protected. We're protected a bit around what construction actually means. And in our case, they've been told they cannot disturb the ground, which means they really can't do anything to our properties at this juncture. It doesn't mean they can't take them, which is where we sit. That means that, you know, anytime now they can go to court and say, look, we're ready to proceed with eminent domain and condemnation proceedings with respect to these properties. So that threat is still very much alive. Now, I think we're positioned well with legal counsel to try to stop that. We did initially ask the courts to stay eminent domain proceedings, and when the lawsuits were filed, they chose not to do that. Once again, Pembina is saying we don't have any plans to do that. We're not really going to proceed. We were very concerned about the COVID-19 virus and exposures as a result of anybody accessing our land and our properties. So given what's going on right now at FERC, and given what's gone on as abuses with other pipeline folks in other parts of the country, I think we might be a little... I don't know. I don't want to know that I want to say we're safe, but I do think that we might be a little more, the courts may give us a stay if they try to start condemnation proceedings, especially in light of the history now with FERC not granting them the pass on securing the 401 permit as well as the coastal zone management consistency. So I think we're well positioned for the courts to support us in getting a stay if need be. But that's a very black cloud that still is hanging over our heads.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFDLPFM and KODXLPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking about the impending demise of the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline. And we just heard from Douglas County property owner Stacy McLaughlin, who's been in this fight for a number of years, almost as long as this pipeline has been a threat to Southern Oregon. And we've also been talking with Klamath Modoc artist Kaila Farrell-Smith and Allie Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate. Well, in the last few moments we have, I wonder what your vision is now. Let's start with Allie. Now that, well, let's hope that this pipeline and the export terminal meet their demise in the next few months. Allie, where do you plan to go from here?
That's a great question. You know, we are going to continue fighting this project until there's no threat over anybody's head that, like, remains today. So we are committed to ensuring that this project is really fully stopped. And beyond that, we're committed in Southern Oregon, Rogue Climate, to working for practical solutions to climate change, for clean energy and investment in energy efficiency to really stoke this just transition to clean energy. So we are, you know, working on state and local policy that help move forward good clean energy projects that are good for communities. and help us alleviate, help stop from new projects like this being proposed. And, you know, hopefully we can create an Oregon where no one ever has to fight a pipeline and a fossil fuel export terminal ever again. And hopefully that goes beyond Oregon very shortly. So we will continue to be doing that work. And, you know, of course, in Jackson County, especially, we're going to be continuing supporting people who have been so severely impacted by climate change with this year's Almeda fire and all the fires across Oregon. So we're in it for the long haul, and we're not going to stop talking about Jordan Cove until it's truly dead. And we're going to continue doing this work that's so needed to build a just transition to clean energy and support people impacted by climate crisis already.
Well, I can really see, as you just mentioned, the fires. And to me, that's like a new direction that we are recognizing we have to really take on. And I've been approached by a couple of people about talking about post-fire logging, which is now threatening the Umpqua and the Mackenzie Rivers. And I just wonder how we tie all these concerns together. And I know that Rogue Climate has been doing a really good job of this, Alice. I just wonder, do you see broadening the web of issues that you're taking on?
I mean, we were presented with a crisis we could have never have dreamed last summer. Dreamed isn't the right word, like nightmared. And we are having to rise to that occasion, right? And so we're supporting the, you know, thousands of people who are displaced by the Almeda fire. And that's critical work that we have to do in the movement for climate justice. Like, we have to be able to hold and support the people who have been impacted by this crisis. So we think that, you know, responding to this fire is so connected to our work, and so critical to be doing right now, and also really critical to create communities where people can come back to. They can come back to their homes after crises like this happen. So that is a big piece of where Rogue Climate's heart is right now in Jackson County, and will continue to be until families and our neighbors can return to a little bit of normalcy.
Well, Stacey, a while back you were mentioning how the lesbian gay community has really gotten on board with fighting Jordan Cove and connected with a wider part of the community that it had probably very little contact with before. And it kind of is a very personal thing for me because I've spent a lot of time way back in the 70s on a piece of land not that far from you, the Oregon Women's Land Trust. When I was spending time down there in the 70s and early 80s, my sense was that the women that I was hanging out with really didn't know their neighbors at all. And I just wonder how that's changed. There's one person I think we could mention, Frances Etherington, who has done a lot of work in a lot of forest work. And I just wanted to get a sense from you about the kind of connections and how particularly your neighbor has been relating to meeting some of these amazing women.
You know, I think it's, like I said earlier, it's a bit of a growth, personal growth, and having an understanding of different people and different lifestyles. And instead of looking at it as a different lifestyle or as something that is, you look at the person, you get to know the person, you know, who might be a part of that community. You get to know someone who is of a different race or cultural background and have an understanding of their struggle and what they've dealt with. And clearly there is, you know, I need to say this, and that is that, you know, right now women have really stepped up, not only in the climate fight and in social justice, but in all aspects of our life. And I think we have to start really looking at that female influence and that leadership as being what our future really holds for us. I think that time has come. And I think that people are going to go down fighting around, men in particular are going to go down fighting around some of that. And I want to commend the folks who really have stepped up in all of this, Rogue Climate in particular. Landowners were organized. Landowners were Lucy, and we had our, you know, we knew who we were. We had meetings, we had things underway, and we had things, you know, that we were approaching. But I want to say that, you know, Rogue Climate really stepped up. And when you talk, Barbara, about going forward, what's next, I think one of the things that has to be next is the model that was developed in Oregon. And that model is, and I've got over 40 years in local government, state government, and tiptoed around the federal government somewhat in my career. And I can legitimately say that this is an organization and a model that really can be replicated. Rogue Climate was very instrumental in bringing both the environmental community, the private property owner community, and the government entities and the tribes together in a way to where we were able to really create and take all of our individual voices, and as Allie shared earlier, make that one really big, loud voice and for the state of Oregon. And I think that that's something we owe to the rest of the nation, is what we did and how we did it and how everybody worked together. And so I think that's another, that's something we have to honor in the future, is what we did and how we did it as being a way to move forward. And I think that alone creates that open window that you're talking about learning about other people and who they are and what they're all about. And I can tell you, my neighbor, you know, when his daughter got pregnant, he stopped using pesticides. And, you know, and that was because of the influence of the people, and maybe in particular, Francis. Francis Etherington has a very strong reputation and background in environmental justice and taking care of the land and forestry in our community. So I think Oregon, you know, we pioneered an approach, and I think it's really served us well.
Well, one final thing, Kayla, I just wonder what you see as the road ahead and how you see your people moving ahead with the experience of having worked with all these people that probably never would have given them the time of day before this fight started.
Thanks, Barbara. Yeah, with the question of moving forward, I mean, I will continue to use my platform as an artist, as a writer, and as an activist to talk about these issues impacting my tribe's water and land and our ancestral hunting grounds, our treaty rights. My ancestors were 1864 treaty signers. So, you know, I feel very, very connected to this place. I work for Signal Fire, which is an artist and activist residency program. So we do programming in back public lands, tribal lands, and backcountry travel. So hiking, kayaking, that kind of stuff. And so I've designed the Indigenous Artist Retreat through Signal Fire. And so that's bringing, you know, Native people from all different tribes from across the country, Ojibwe, from Navajo. We've had many people come here to Southern Oregon. And I've led trips out to Heart Mountain to visit our petroglyphs and our hot springs. So that's been a really unique thing of where we don't have to code switch, so like designing spaces. And so with the tribe here, so a lot of my work and my vision is I really do want to talk about that post-wildfire logging. I was really traumatized. I went up to my Spring Creek, which is a sacred springs to the Klamath women specifically, and they've completely clear-cut the ponderosa pine forest right above that watershed, and it's devastating, and I don't know what's going on. So I want answers to what's happening here. And I think it's happening around the state, but really I want to be working on rights of Mother Nature, specifically for our waterways, for our chawam, for our suckerfish, which are almost, you know, that are endangered. And so that's a really, really important thing that we're working on. But the Klamath tribe, we got some of our land back. And so the land back movement is something that I'm working on personally. And once I kind of felt like we were in a good place of fighting Jordan Cove, I really reached out to other Indigenous land defenders and water protectors like Conahoos Freedom Manual, the Manual Sisters of the Tiny House Warriors, who are fighting Trans-Canada, and they're protecting their Sepwemek homelands. And we also talked with Tacoma LNG, Dakota Case, Puyallup Water Protectors. And we had a webinar, and then we also spoke with Slato, Molly Wickham, who's the spokesperson for Gitinim Checkpoint at the Wet'suwet'en, who are fighting the RCMP. They have the cops right, you know, in their communities and territories during COVID. So it's really scary. And so like kind of overall, just in general, I don't want to see any large infrastructure projects, even if it's massive solar wind for data centers for like Google and Facebook, which I know is something. We're corporate captured. So like, it's just a fight about corporations. So, you know, coming together, we want to protect our communities from these man camps, which directly impact Indigenous women's health and, you know, links to like sex trafficking and stuff. So we still have a lot to fight for in Oregon, and I'll be here.
And it looks like the first of the Klamath River dams is going to be coming out, too, in the next year. So that's a good thing to look forward to as well.
Hopefully.
Yes, I hope so, too.
We're looking forward to that. And I joined the Chiloquin Kayak Club, so we're getting excited if we can get some little rapids.
Well, I want to thank Kaila Farrell-Smith, who is a MODOC Klamath artist, Allie Rosenbluth with Rural Climate, and Stacy McLaughlin, a landowner in Douglas County who's been fighting the Jordan Cove LNG terminal and Pacific Connector pipeline for the good part of her adult life. Thank you all for joining us. It's been great to talk to you today.
Thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Douglas County property owner Stacy McLaughlin, Klamath MODOC artist Kaila Farrell-Smith, and Allie Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO, renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.